Welcome to the Magnificast, a podcast about Christianity and leftist politics. I'm your co-host, Matt Bernico.
And I'm your other co-host, Dean Detloff. And I'm also joined by one of my cats who has decided he's going to purr on my lap for an undefined amount of time. So we have a third host this time.
That's extremely pleasant. I got to tell you, my cat is also in the room and she's in a little castle. Yeah.
The Magnificats are here.
Just as the cats are occupying these rooms, college students and university students across the United States have been creating some very serious and not cat related encampments. God, I got to stop already. in their universities, you've probably seen it on the news. You've probably seen it online, but there are protests in 45 out of the 50 yet to be United States. I think 80 different U.S. campuses and maybe more at this point. It's hard to say. Arrests and other types of police repression have occurred at probably all of those, but arrests specifically at 40 of those campuses. All kinds of other protests have sprung up around the world in solidarity with Palestine and the people in Gaza, in places like Argentina, Australia, Canada, in the UK, in Ireland, in Italy, all kinds of places, man. Spain. Spain's one of them. Yemen. They're all in here. People are doing this. We're upset, and rightfully so. Dean, what's your experience as a person who's been online, been of these protests? I mean, we're both old now, and we aren't on university campuses anymore, but you better believe we're watching. Dean, what have you been thinking and seeing online?
What I see online is never exciting, usually, but I have found this particularly exciting, energizing, interesting. It's been kind of fascinating to watch the discourse around this trigger, also a repetition of many other reactions to other kinds of protests that we've seen in the past. But I think there's something different going on here as well. What I mean by that is you see a lot of the same rhetoric being trotted out that usually gets trotted out when people are mad that people are in the streets or are willing to, I don't know, get beat by police or not be moved or even engage in property destruction here and there. All the same kind of arguments are coming out about those kinds of actions. But I think what's fascinating is also seeing the set of demands from students is, I think, pulling out a lot of undisclosed information from universities. It's making people more sensitized to how financial systems work, how universities are funded, how imperialism works, the kind of link between global elites and the reproduction of elites in higher ed institutions and kind of how that relates to geopolitics. So it feels like, on the one hand, all the critics are boring. They're all doing the same stuff that they always do. They can't think of anything new to say because it is all a repetition of bad ideas. But the protesters, I think, are doing some really creative things, and that's been exciting to watch. This is like exciting to me specifically, a person whose brain is broken by reading philosophy and stuff, but there was a great post not too long ago I saw of Columbia students had like mapped out the relationships within their university that were impinging on the protesters and on the issue of Palestine generally. So like naming certain trustees and creating arrows and boxes and diagrams, kind of just showing people like who is where in the power chain and how does that affect students. And man, I love seeing stuff like that. I love seeing people really systematize the situation and trying to figure out what are the, you know, the various points of intervention. So I feel like that's really exciting. Cool to see people really strategizing around this. And that's giving me energy in an otherwise frustrating situation. What about you, Matt? What are you seeing online?
Man, so much. First of all, being in the being across the sea in Scotland has made me sort of like, I think, removed from this in a particularly weird way, where I will wake up in the morning and see everything that's happened in the previous day's afternoon, which is bizarre. But yeah, what I've been seeing has been really interesting. I've been following Mel Buer, who actually she was on the show an extremely long time ago because she used to be on this other podcast. But anyway, she's now a reporter for The Real News and does all kinds of interesting sort of protest and labor reporting. She's very cool. I'm appreciative of the work that she does. She spent a few days at UCLA following the encampment there, and she was out like overnight doing like basically like war reporting on the encampment and the ensuing counter protest and like the violence and the police repression that kind of came out of it. So anyways, following that was such a weird thing to see. I mean, her coverage of it was as good as it can be as someone who's like in the middle of a huge chaotic scene. I mean, it was great to follow her on Twitter and just like see what was happening. It is such an interesting thing to see, like, I think, first of all, how this has catalyzed a lot of university students. And that's, I think, really great. And they're organizing around it, and it's really empowering. And that's cool. I find the opposition to these encampments so bizarre, and I can't quite figure out what's happening there. Maybe because I'm not there, I'm not doing like all of the research work or whatever. But at the UCLA protest that I followed, that Mel was at, there were people who were like, you know, attacking the protesters. And it's just like, where are these people coming from is my biggest question. I don't know. It seems such like a bizarre thing. I mean, I know that there are people in the United States who are Zionists. That is not surprising to me. But that they would like actually show up and like and do that seems like just it seems outside of what I would expect, which is maybe my own problem. But anyways, I guess that was a really shocking moment, I think, to see like just how staunch the opposition is, that it's not just police repression, but there's other types of yucky Zionist stuff going on as well that I'm not a fan of.
Yeah, and it's revealing all the double standards and all of that and showing policing to be what it is. For example, you know, it's been interesting to see academics themselves be either politicized or not by this whole situation. But something that many academics, especially in the South, have been pointing out is, you know, the police were not reacting this strongly when there are like literally Nazis carrying torches around in, you know, in North Carolina or whatever. And that is pretty revealing. Like a literally anti-Semitic fascist march doesn't draw out, you know, tons and tons of police repression with stories of, I mean, some people got arrested at those kinds of things, but nothing like what you're seeing here. And there's a pretty obvious like economy of scale, I think, in terms of how the state responds to these kinds of crises. It's the same kind of thing that people raise when they talk about free speech crises at campuses, that, you know, universities will always say they kind of have a duty to preserve the right for like whatever the biggest fascist YouTuber of the day is going to say or something on their campus. And they even go out of their way to invite those folks to their campuses, but they don't, you know. The horseshoe theory is not real. They don't do the same for the radical left or whatever. And I think you're kind of seeing that. And I'm curious to find out whether or not that will really radicalize other professors too, to sort of understand that, you know, the cops are not on their side either, even though I think a lot of academics see themselves as maybe, you know, more part of the establishment, and it kind of takes a lot to rock their boat. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, big time. A perennial sort of revisiting of the topic of free speech in the left is always very interesting to see. I always think about the Wobblies and the fight for free speech,
yeah,
because they were, you know, getting jailed for organizing labor. And I guess maybe the same here, right? There's no free speech if you can't critique Israel, if you can't critique the massive investment of U.S. arms and stuff. Well, anyways, in this episode, in case you haven't guessed, we're going to be talking about the ongoing encampments and the Palestinian solidarity movement in the United States on university campuses. As Dean and I have already said, we're not on university campuses. We're too old for that kind of thing now. And we also are in different geographic places that, you know, maybe prohibit us from like being there in person or whatever. But anyways, we thought it would be great to take a moment and kind of think through what's happening there in those places, and also maybe cover a bit of the religious reporting angle from some of these places as well. It's always great. Being a person that has a religious reporting brain means that you're always looking for this angle. And today we've just kind of rounded up a few articles of people who have found this angle for us. And we're going to talk about what's been going on and maybe like what the interest is of Christian people who are participating and also antagonizing these protests. But before we do, Dean, I think it might be good just to talk a little bit about like what it is that these protesters are calling for or asking for, like what their demands are. And I think something that is probably not immediately obvious to people who are maybe suspicious of these protests is what universities have to do with Palestinian liberation anyways. I think for people on the left, it's not that surprising that the big universities across the United States are in some ways embroiled and connected with in arms research and arms production that will end up benefiting Israel in a handful of ways. So anyways, I think it's good to talk about divestment as maybe a strategy, but also at, like what it actually looks like at this moment. So I think this might be a good place to start. So why universities are embroiled in this whole thing in the first place, why university students care about this, it's because the universities that they go to, they pay money to, that they attend, that they live at, they all in some way prop up Israel as a state and the apartheid of Palestine. Here's a quote from Time magazine, time.com, that kind of lays some of it out in just like some boring terms. Divestment from Israel is one of the demands echoed by student demonstrators nationwide. At several colleges, students have erected tents on campus grounds as they rally for their cause, calling on universities to sell off investments from Israeli companies and those with ties to Israel, such as Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Alphabet, and Amazon. About 100 U.S. colleges have reported gifts or contracts from Israel totaling $375 million over the past two decades, according to a Department of Education database. Dean, what do you think about those numbers? $375 million? It's a lot of money. That's a lot of Snickers bars that you could buy yourself.
It's a lot of money. It's a lot of bad money. Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said earlier, something that's so interesting about these encampments on universities is that they are provoking these kinds of arrangements to be more public. Universities are so weird. I mean, it's a common joke, especially in big universities, that universities are essentially a big hedge fund with like maybe a hospital. And sometimes people read, you know, old dusty philosophy books or something. They're essentially like real estate managers, hedge funds. They have a bunch of money invested in the market. And those investments are like lots of investments invested seeking a profit, right? They're not exactly like making ethical choices about where to put their money to grow a healthy economy. They're making choices about money that will grow their own investment. It has a life and logic of its own. And I think what these encampments are really helping people see is that universities could have a choice. They could choose what to invest in, and that means they could also choose what to divest in. But it's actually not even as simple as that. Like the University of Ohio, for example, had publicly stated that there's a law in Ohio that they are saying makes it illegal to divest from Israel specifically, which is pretty wild. It's like on the books that you can't divest from your investments in Israel. And I think this is also an interesting thing that the encampments are showing just how kind of intertwined Zionist geopolitics are with even the U.S. political system. Like the obsession with supporting Israel no matter what, with no qualifications, is so strong that it affects, you know, that tried and true value of U.S. capitalism that you can't just choose to put your money wherever you want, which I think is pretty wild. So it's interesting just to see how the material conditions that make universities possible, that make global imperialism possible, and so on, are bubbling up to the surface in light of a bunch of people refusing to get off the lawn.
The Ohio law, that sounds wild. I can't believe it, but I'm believing it actively. So divestment, that is a pretty common sense goal then from these protesters, to publicly state that the money is going there and then to find ways to get their universities to withdraw, to find, you know, which levers of power they need to pull to get their universities to respond in the right way. Totally makes sense. Great tactic. 10 out of 10. That's cool stuff. Man, I've seen another thing online in the past week that I really hate, and let me tell you about it. So in response to a lot of protests, I've seen a lot of smug and smarmy responses from people saying, oh, if these university students love Palestine so much, let's send them there and they can go to school in Palestine. No joke. That's been a real tweet that I've seen more than one person tweet, and it's dumb. Let me tell you why. It's dumb because no student in Gaza has been able to attend school since November 6, 2023. That's why it's dumb. On November 6, 2023, the Ministry of Education in Gaza suspended the entire school year because the war had been because Israel has indiscriminately targeted residential areas, including schools and their offices and so on. Israel says, obviously, that they're defending themselves in that, which is, I think, a crazy thing to say. But anyways, why can these protesters not go to Palestine and go to school there? Because there's no schools in Palestine left. They've all been bombed. Here's another fact from an Al Jazeera article that I think is actually pretty good to weigh on your brain in a really awful way. They said that up to 280 government schools and 65 UNRWA schools have been destroyed or damaged, according to Palestinian Ministry of Education. Now, those are like primary schools and high schools, not universities. But I'll get to those in just 1 second. Later on in this like same Al Jazeera article, it says that centers of higher education, including universities, have been completely paralyzed. Palestinian news agency Wafa reported that 12 higher education institutions in Gaza have been destroyed or damaged, completely disrupting the university education. All right, folks, there it is. That's the other reason why I think the encampments on university campuses are such a big deal. Divestment, obviously, the schools that these kids go to, the schools that the students are going to, I apologize again for being an old person, they are actively propping up Israel and the apartheid state. That's bad. They're propping up the genocide. That's bad. We don't like it. The other reason is that because, I mean, like, that's a, there's a type of solidarity that they're expressing, too, with other students elsewhere in the world, right? The students of Gaza, Palestinian students, they cannot go to school because their schools have been destroyed. Full stop. That's it. Not that, like, some of them have been destroyed, but they're, like, all destroyed. And if they're not destroyed, they're being used as, like, a refuge place for people to gather because of the rest of the carnage of the whole thing. Which is really just a sickening situation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one thing I find kind of hopeful about all this too, the encampments, is student politics are really complicated in the U.S. and Canada, especially. There are lots of stories in the history of both of these countries where, you know, students, they got wild, like they made a choice, they did something, you know, a big sit-in at a campus or whatever, and it got so intense and students have been killed for resisting war and so on. You know, you think of like Kent State and so many other examples, even during the civil rights movement, these really kind of powerful moments in history where students have been at the forefront of making a change and building a political culture in these countries. And I think always too about so many of the kind of movements that we remember and think about in, you know, maybe like we think about them as like guiding lights or something like that, or important precedents like the Black Panther Party or the Young Lords. So many of those movements were made up of students as well. Like they were literally students who also were part of these other organizations, a lot younger than we often remember them as. And that is all really cool, but student politics has been basically dormant in terms of student identity. I mean, there's exceptions to that. Sometimes students are willing to kind of get upset about this or that. Obviously, certain schools or certain student unions have maybe a deeper living memory and can organize something or can, you know, get a strike going. And there's been a lot of great student activism around like getting grad unions and stuff like that. But in terms of like international student to student politics, it's just my impression anyway, that has sort of died down. And I feel like this is a moment where students are coming to a consciousness about their own relationship to other students elsewhere in the world, and not only in Gaza, but with all the students who are also starting encampments on universities, that it's a sort of shared commitment to what it means to be a student, trying to learn, trying to figure out the world around you, and trying also to learn the skills that you'll need to make change in society. And that has been really exciting to see. And there has been some progress. You mentioned, Matt, the very, very many campuses that are experiencing this right now. Some of them have already achieved at least some concessions from their school boards or school administration. Some have gotten guarantees of having meetings with boards to kind of present their case for divestment. Some have also gotten even some movement around administration signaling that maybe they're open to that. In fact, all that stuff remains to be seen. That's like something an administration, I can imagine, would say if they want to get, you know, all these kids off of their lawn so that when it comes to like admission season, they don't have pictures of like police beating their students going around. But at the same time, you know, these are kind of real gains. And students also are starting to be organized as real dialogue partners with administration, you know, like they're recognized as people who can negotiate around demands. And I think all that will also become more and more complicated as the practicalities get sort of hammered out of what students are really demanding and what they want and how to get it. But all that to say, I think it's just kind of a moment of a generally dormant student population, politically speaking, starting to stand on its own two feet. And I think that's actually very good news for the left general, like just kind of speaking about Palestine and many other things beyond. It's good that students are figuring out what they can do together.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe one more quick shout out about those, about the student identity bit that you mentioned a minute ago. I think it's actually really interesting. Kind of evolving out of this whole situation is that UAW 48411, sorry, just pulling it out of my head. it's one of the biggest academic workers union. At least it's the biggest in California, if not the entire country. I'd imagine it's the biggest in the country. Sorry, I should probably have these facts straight, but I don't. Anyways, they are voting on a strike in light of the police protests in LA. So it's like that's I think a really interesting moment within this whole thing, mm-hmm. where you know, it moves. I mean, it comes from like a self-identification of like students as a type of identity, but also the rights and like the union, the academic workers who are, I mean, all probably mostly grad students, I would imagine. They won a union and now they can kind of act in this particular way because of a clearly hostile working environment. Mm-hmm. Just a wild situation. But anyways, a really positive thing to see that that the grad student workers are willing to go on strike over this all. And they should. It's absolutely correct to do so. Police showing up and like beating up you and your friends and your students is not good. And you should definitely go on strike if that's the case.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
So just like what I'm saying, though, is that like, you know, it's like I think that maybe the vision that people have of like what a student is in their brain is not always what students are in practice, or mm-hmm. like what grad students are in practice, or what grad student workers are in practice. Right. And understanding themselves as not just like people receiving a service from a university, but right. also recognizing themselves as workers within the whole apparatus of the university, and winning a union because of it, it can be a big thing. Mm-hmm. So if you're a grad student and you're listening to this, please, please unionize. That's all I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that's right. Easier said than done, but it can be done. The wild thing too about all this is I think because, you know, we've seen all the rhetoric around the street protests in general that you'd expect. It's the same rhetoric that you always see around street protests. But because the student protests are becoming maybe a more like localized flashpoint, they're also giving rise to lots of takes, and including among Christians, both good takes and bad takes. Lots of bad takes, as you can guess. We'll talk about some of them in a minute, some good ones too. But I think it's been interesting also to find out how Christians are engaging all of this. Toward the end of the episode, maybe we'll turn to speculate a little bit more about what that could mean or whatever. But something I've really appreciated is actually following on Twitter. A lot of theology students are getting involved. A lot of students on Catholic campuses are getting involved. There's a real Christian presence even within the student protests. I've seen a lot of Christians for Palestine signs at these events. A great account, if you don't already follow it, is Terre Nouvelle 2. I don't know how to describe it. It's a blog. Let's just start there. Maybe that posts lots of pretty wild niche Catholic lefty content. And there's a lot more to say about it. If you're on Twitter for a long time, you'll have a better idea of what's going on with this account. But anyway, it's TerreNouvelle2, Terre Nouvelle 2. And they have been doing a lot of really cool stuff, just pulling out what's going on at Fordham University, in particular the Jesuit school there, and kind of making a point to highlight the Christian presence at a lot of these student protests in New York in particular. So all that to say, like, I think it's activating Christians in every way that you would expect, right? It's activating the Christian commentariat. Thankfully, they have lots to write, and you know, they're not going to be out of a job because of this, thankfully for them, I guess, for better and for worse. And there are also a movement kind of piece of Christians being activated by it. So I find that all very fascinating. Something that the religion left journalists have not fully covered, but maybe are starting to pay some attention to.
Yeah, big time. Well, let's talk about some of that, the Christian commentariat. I love it. Being a member of it myself, big fan of what we do. Cool. I've rounded up three different takes here, not takes necessarily, but three different aspects of like religion reporting that has been going on around the campus protests, the encampments, and all that great stuff. One that is more like a theological observation from Sojourners. One that is from the President Serene Jones of Union Theological Seminary about like what her response has been as a university administrator who's been kind of sucked into the protests. And then finally, an article by Fiona Andre in Religion in the Religion News Service about Sean Foyt and his rally at Columbia, because don't we all love to hate Sean Foyt? I think that's it. It's important to keep him in the mix and keep an eye on like what's happening with regards to, I hate the word Christian nationalists, but the Christian nationalist kind of group of people, because of course they're going to show up and do gross and weird things. So anyways, we're talking about all those things. And then of course, because we are podcasters, we are going to do some speculation at the end. So first let's take a look at an article in Sojourners called Student Encampments Echo Jesus's Parable of Annoying the Powerful by Brooke Foster. Annoying the powerful is such a great term. And I'm pretty sure we've said something similar on the podcast before. But you definitely get the feeling of Jesus annoying the powerful throughout the Gospels. He's always doing it. He's always being a pain in their sides. It's great. The whole article, like I said, is on Sojourners. Go take a look at it. I think it's great. What I like about Sojourners articles is that they're always going to tell you why Christians should care about something. And there's always going to be an article on their website that's like, this is what you can send to the Christian in your life who like maybe just like does not get it. And this is definitely that article. Brooke Foster wrote this article. She is a person who has an MDiv from Princeton, where there is an encampment. So that's the connection there. Anyways, she writes, Christian faith commends those who are relentless in their pursuit of justice, especially those who do so with limited access to power and great personal risk. I'm reminded of the parable Jesus tells his disciples about a widow and unjust judge. This is Luke 18, 1-8. In case you missed Sunday school that week. The widow, Jesus explains, is petitioning for justice from a judge who neither feared God nor had respect for people. And each time the judge withholds justice, the widow returns, disrupting the court, bothering the judge, and generally raising a ruckus. Eventually, the judge relents, apparently from sheer annoyance. Scripture recounts the judge thinking to himself, I will grant her justice so that she may not wear me out continually coming. Great. be the annoying person you want to see in the world. I love that. And then she goes on to say, when I look at students protesting across the country through the lens of my Christian faith, I see similarly persistence and power and apparent powerlessness. As protests continue, students facing potentially life-altering consequences like police violence, arrest, expulsion, eviction, job loss, and damage to their career prospects. Yet I see many students continuing to use the social capacity they have at U.S. universities to seek an end to state-sanctioned violence and the financial structures that uphold it, that Gaza health authorities estimate has executed at least 34,488 Palestinians, wounded nearly 78,000 more, and manufactured a looming famine in the enclave. So cool, a good take. This parable about the widow and the unjust judge from Luke, this is just one of many places where Jesus is kind of telling a story about somebody being annoying to somebody else in power. If you need more of those, you can listen to the rest of our podcast because we talk about them quite a bit. lots of parables that tell something similar, right? You have to kind of like be annoying to people, tell people the news they don't want to hear, do all kinds of things. That's Christianity, folks. That's the social gospel, is be annoying to people who are in power. But I think there's something to it, right? That's interesting. It's a good way to kind of think about what students are doing. It's not different. It's not different than what this parable is talking about. And I think that's a cool observation to make.
Yeah. I mean, it is also just true in general, right? It's one of those perennial evergreen facts that people in power just basically don't want to be bothered. That's like the thing that really gets them going. The judge grants this this person justice because he's just getting tired of it, getting sick of it. And it's the same with our own politicians. I mean, I think anybody who's ever had to do lobbying work knows that at the beginning, like, you can try your best to be nice to the government in hopes that they would be nice to you back. And like, sometimes that does work. I think that's also important to say, like, you know, we can have a diversity of tactics for sure. But a lot of times it does not work. Actually, pretty much every time you have to find a way to be a bother, to be annoying, to stay on somebody's agenda, to basically be like, you can't be safely ignored and just let the issue go away or die down or kind of let the news cycle move on. And I think that is actually also something I found really inspiring about these encampments. I don't know, like, I spend a lot of my day-to-day job thinking about Palestine and trying to do things related to it, and it is becoming increasingly hard to do. I think there is news fatigue around it. I think also there's a sense of hopelessness around it. People are like, we've tried every avenue at this stage. We've talked to every person we could. You know, we yelled at politicians. We said nice things to politicians. We've sat in their offices, all this kind of stuff. And still, like, you know, the government is approving all these weapons to be sent to Israel every month or whatever. You know, like, there's a lot of fatigue, I guess, setting in with people who are, like, maybe forced to do this one way or another in a professional capacity, and no doubt also the many people for whom their conscience compels them to do that. And I think what's great about the student encampments in particular is that it shows that actually there are new avenues that haven't been tried. There are more people that need to be annoyed and could be annoyed. And the more we kind of like build the, you know, the aggregate annoyance, that's kind of the key to getting something sorted. So it is a great parable to point out. And also kudos to Sojourners for, you know, giving platforms to those kinds of things. Just seeing the coverage that happens in a lot of Christian media these days, there's still a lot of kind of both sidesism going on. And I think it's great that Sojourners is kind of allowing at least that sort of affirmation to be heard there.
Yeah, big time. They've posted a few different articles that have been about the Palestinian genocide that, I mean, it's good. Christians should be talking about it, and glad to see that Sojourners can play sort of a leadership role in making that happen. Great. Sojourners, love it. Theological takes, great. Parables, the best. But let's talk about something different. So universities, they, like Dean mentioned a minute ago, are, you know, hedge funds with a with a hospital attached to them. There's a few universities, though, that have had some different responses to the ongoing student protests. And one of them is Union Theological Seminary, which is, I think, a quite it's an interesting story. So in their religion news service, they published a sort of like first person type of essay about what their experience was with regards to the encampment. But it's written by Serene Jones, the president of Union Theological Seminary. So she has this pretty cool take about what the encampments have been like and like what she's seen at them. And what I like about it is that she centers the experiences of the students that are there and not her feelings as a university administrator, because I got to tell you, the people whose feelings I don't care about very much are university administrators. But this one is good. So she writes this: first and foremost, these encampments are filled with students from different religious traditions, Jews, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, unaffiliated, as well as spiritual but not religious students. They are finding solace and courage among themselves, frequently singing songs from a religious summer camp of their parents' own faith-based anti-war protests from the 1960s. That's cool. Great if you have cool parents that make you learn cool songs. Be that kind of parent if you can. On April 21st, the first Sunday in place, I was asked by Union students to accompany them to a Columbia encampment to offer a Christian communion service. I, of course, said yes. A weary group of Union students, alumni, and local clergy bundled up on a very cold spring afternoon, went through the police checkpoints, and formed a circle in the middle of the encampment. One of the many brilliant students preached a sermon on the biblical story of Ezekiel witnessing the vast valley of dry bones, a wrenching text with his present-day corollary in Gaza and Israel. And this is where it gets really good, I think. As she preached, silence fell across the whole encampment as people slowly drew closer. Students listened and wept. I wept tears of intense grief. Some students rocked as they prayed. Some shouted amen. Some sat on the ground, arms wrapped around each other. Another student led a simple open table communion service, inviting everyone to feast. As the Christian ritual unfolded, I watched in awe as the line to take communion grew longer and longer, making it impossible to divide up people into sharply defined traditions. More tears ran down people's faces as they partook, as tears likewise kept running down mine. The next day was the beginning of Passover. In the morning, a large group of Jewish students came to us from the encampment, many of whom had been arrested and either suspended from school or expelled so they couldn't go back on the campus. They asked if they could hold the Seder in our courtyard, and they did. I think this is such a cool story coming from a university administrator, because this person at least has their priorities straight, that the university is, for them, not a hedge fund with a hospital, or a hedge fund in this case with a seminary attached. But it is something different. It is the students who make it up. I think that is profoundly cool to see someone say. Yeah. Gives you hope that maybe not all administrators are bad. It's good. The story about communion, though, I think is really very sweet and also kind of telling about the way that people actually care about religion. If it has something to say to them, then maybe they will actually spend time thinking about it. And this is an example of that happening, but a cool thing to happen, to have a big line of people wanting to eat this Jesus-y bread and not being kind of clear about like who's from what church and just one big line. That's great. The kingdom of God is like a big long line waiting for communion of people who are in a solidarity encampment for Palestine.
Yeah. Like you said, Matt, I think the last opinion that anybody needs to hear on these things is that of university administrators. And I know also people have complicated feelings about Serene Jones, and that is fine. I never went to Union, so I don't have any feelings about her. But I think she is in this particular moment kind of posing a challenge to many of her colleagues that I think is important. She also, Union released a statement from her basically saying that they will not send police on their students and really going out of their way to explain why that is. And, you know, that is dumb to do that. And I think that is also huge because there are lots of other theological schools on the campuses of, you know, bigger public schools where there are huge encampments, and it is crickets from a lot of those schools. And it just leads me at least to wonder, and I would hope a lot of other seminarians as well, like, you know, if your theology school can't be like, police shouldn't be beating students here, then literally what is it for? I sincerely don't know. I don't know why you would have one if you can't pull that off, something as simple as that. And I think it's pretty impressive for Serene Jones in that capacity to be saying that pretty unapologetically at Union and pretty early on as well. Like, she didn't wait around. At least it doesn't seem like that to me. And that is really great. I think it should be posing also a bigger question around the crisis of theological education. And I will be curious to see what both students and different theologians have to say about that kind of coming out of all of this experience. You know, is there maybe a particular prophetic role for theology schools within universities, especially in a moment like this when students are willing to resist a genocide? It's a big test maybe of the relevance of theology schools in general at this moment. That's my hot take as a person who has decided to not be part of that environment right now.
So spicy. All right. Let's hammer out this last article here and then move on with our lives. So this is by Fiona Andre, a reporter at Religion News Service. And this one is about Sean Foyt. So sorry that you have to hear about him. also it's about Sean Foyt, but also Eric Metaxas is another person who I do just not like whatsoever. What a big dummy. All right. The article is called Christian Nationalist Activists Lead Pro-Israel Rally at Columbia University. On Thursday, April 25th, Christian Nationalist Activist and Musician Sean Foyt, Pastor Russell... I cannot. Christian Nationalist Activist is so funny.
Christian Sorry. Nationalist Activist and Musician. The kind of thing that, let's be honest, only a liberal Christian media outlet could possibly come up with.
Exactly. I mean, good for them. They're not wrong, but it's just a funny way. If I would have written it, it would have been like... just giant dumbass Sean Foyt. All right, anyways, Christian nationalist activist and musician Sean Foyt, Pastor Russell Johnson, who I'm not familiar with, and conservative author who I am familiar with, Eric Metaxas, headed to pro-Israel rally at Columbia University in response to the Gaza solidarity encampment established by students a week ago. I hate this so much. Sean Foyt, this is his thing. This is what he does. Like, every time there's a giant protesty movement, this is what he did during the George Floyd protests, is that he would show up on the scene and like confuse people by playing guitar and draw them in or whatever. It's just, it sucks. It sucks that he does this and he goes there. I get though, it's a tactic that probably works. I'm sure that like a guy showing up playing guitar is you don't flag him immediately as a shill for genocide, but that's what he's doing. Okay. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure Sean Foyt has like a ridiculous sneaker collection that's been funded by his pro genocide performances. Okay. Oh my God. That's exactly what, oh my, yes, that's what it is. That's a Dungeons and Dragons campaign waiting to happen. Anyways, this rally, it's called the United for Israel rally, and it was advertised on social media beginning on Wednesday. This is now weeks ago, but it happened. And it was intended to show support for Israel, Jewish students, and faculties. It drew a crowd of a few hundred who circled the Columbia campus singing hymns and praying without entering its gates. That's what it was advertised as. Instead, what they basically did was yell at people. That's kind of what it came down to. So Sean Foyt, he kickstarted the whole event by intoning the Christian anthem, "How Great is Our God," before blessing the crowd and praying for
Israel.
So
funny, by the way. Incredibly anti-Semitic.
Yep. Big time. Sean Foyt says that today we say enough is enough. This anti-Christ and anti-Semitic agenda that has risen up in New York City, that has risen up in universities. He said, "I hate this so much. I hate when evangelical Christians talk about anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is a real thing and it's bad and it's a problem. Like, for sure. I don't know. Talk to like people who are like active in a Jewish community in your area and they will tell you that it's a problem. And I believe them. Anti-Semitism is bad. Mm-hmm. But also, it's like so hollow coming from somebody like Sean Foyt, who literally only believes that Israel is good because of like an end times prophecy, which is also very anti-Semitic, if you think about it. And I'm thinking about it. So anyways, the article goes on to say, the day before in a live stream, Foyt said that there had been a rise in anti-Semitism on campuses due to the pro-Palestinian student protest, and it was a sign of the end times that they were near. The end times were near. College kids, you didn't know that they were that's one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Sean Foyt says that we're seeing this rise in this flood of anti-Semitism across the world. These are the end days. I know people will say this all the time, and everyone's always saying that this is the end of the world. Well, these are the end days. One day closer, the return of Jesus.
I've never heard anyone say that before.
Well, listen, people are always saying it, and I'm saying it too, Sean Foyt says, which is... I love that rhetoric, because like people are always saying it's the end of the world, and you know it's not true, but this time it is definitely true. Okay. Finally, adding that the Israel-Hamas war, which is not a phrase I would choose, but it's the one that this writer has, adding that the Israel-Hamas war is one of these end times issues, Foyt said that Christians need to get right by siding with Israel. Reading aloud a verse from the 12th chapter of the Bible's book of Genesis, referring to God's covenant with Abraham, Foyt said it was a Christian duty to support Israel. Dean, can you tell me about why this is anti-Semitic actually to say this?
Sure. I mean, this is just one of these end times issues, so it's pretty easy to talk about. You know, the key here is that Sean Foyt is not showing up to support the Jews or to fight anti-Semitism. And I think, I mean, this is something that probably everybody who listens to this podcast has already thought about, but is maybe worth saying now. You know, the fact that someone would stylize the protests on campuses as anti-Semitic in and of themselves is already an anti-Semitic assumption, because it erases the Jews who are there at great cost to themselves and creating, I'm sure, a lot of problems in their own lives and identities and so on, because they do not support genocide as Jewish people and so on. You know, they're erasing that experience entirely by kind of painting this as an anti-Semitic thing, and which also is not to deny that there are anti-Semitic slogans and rhetoric that make their way into protest movements around this issue, and I think that sucks. But also, protesters are aware of that, and you know, whatever, protests are complicated, and this is all part of it. But all that to say, Sean Foyt is already being anti-Semitic just by virtue of kind of stylizing it that way, erasing Jews out of the picture entirely. But more, maybe in a complicated way, it's theologically anti-Semitic here, because the idea is that Sean Foyt doesn't think that you should support Israel because you support the Jews writ large, or because you oppose anti-Semitism, or you value Judaism as a, you know, faith community or tradition or whatever. He thinks that you should support Israel because it factors into the incredibly weird chess game of evangelical dispensational theology, where by the end of it, Jews basically have a choice. Either they will submit to the Messiah, to Jesus Christ, and kind of learn that they were wrong the whole time to have denied him, and that was a huge mistake. And finally, they got right by becoming Christians, thereby erasing their Judaism, or they are fighting in this big battle and die in a battle against the forces of the beast and the Antichrist, which is also pretty anti-Semitic to assume that like your only contribution to the end times, if you don't convert, is to essentially fight a war with the people who don't like Jesus. Or you perish just like every other non-believer and go to hell. There's no fast track to heaven for people who don't accept Jesus Christ, including the Jews, if you're in the Sean Foyt theological magical universe. And I think that is something that, you know, a lot of Jews also rightly understand. Even Zionist Jews are like mad that Sean Foyt is doing this, which I think is very wild. A whole situation for them, I guess, to sort out. But yeah, there's an anti-Semitism baked into the way that these particular Christians think that the end times will happen, and baked into why they support Israel. And also, like, the state of Israel knows that, and they accept that. I mean, they take that for granted. They find their allies where they can. And I think it's, you know, it's telling that there's a kind of cynicism about accepting certain kinds of anti-Semitism as long as it allows you to call other things, that is, opposition to Israeli genocide, anti-Semitic. So that's a huge rhetorical piece that, you know, especially if you're outside the kind of evangelical world, maybe doesn't come across very obviously.
Thank you for explaining that. That's very, very good. A very helpful explainer. Sean Foyt, what a big idiot. Don't like this guy. Eric Metaxas, just as bad, if not worse. You know what I don't like about Eric Metaxas? First of all, I don't like he's on Twitter. And I don't like that I've seen occasionally some of the things he said. He also wrote a book about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I hate that he did that. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is like, you know, he could be such a cool sort of like leftist Christian character, and I think he is. But Eric Metaxas is really trying to make it happen for the right, and that sucks. In a big way. Not a fan.
Yeah, I agree.
Eric Metaxas, get lost. Okay. Dean, we've been through it. We've talked about the protests, the encampments. We've been talking about the links to universities. We've been talking about divestment and scholasticide, which is a word I learned recently. But let's talk about some of the big takeaways from this whole thing, this conversation that maybe we can draw out. The thing that I was thinking of mostly is just that, like, this is like the third or fourth big uprising I think I've lived through as a human person, which is really actually interesting. You know, Occupy happened, that's true. But I guess more recent in my brain, or at least more close to home, are the Ferguson protests and the George Floyd protests that have happened in previous years and in the aughts, the late 2000s as they were. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's interesting that we've seen this whole cycle happen so many times already, the cycle of protests and police repression, protests and police repression, and on and on and on. You know, I think in the last sort of round of Black Lives Matter protests, during like the sort of George Floyd era of them, at least, the abolition movement got a lot of steam around the, you know, we heard a lot about defund the police, yes, but then we also heard a lot of more radical voices saying abolish the police altogether. And I don't know, man, sounds good to me. But it's interesting to see how that conversation about policing has developed and the ways that those tropes kind of continue to play out even now. It's not necessarily the protests that is the problem, right? It's the police that are the problem. It's the extreme response from police officers every time that is problematic. In St. Louis, there was a really, I don't want to say it was small because that would be mean to the people that were there. And it probably wasn't small, but it was just like, it was not an encampment. It was a protest at Washington University, which is like it's a pretty big university in the Midwest. It is definitely a hedge fund with a hospital attached to it. It is like, it's not an Ivy League school, but it's like, you know, adjacent to an Ivy League school. They had a protest on their campus and a lot of very brave students stood out there and like were present and were kind of showing their anger at the university and their investment policies. But the cops came down so hard on them, unbelievably hard, and, you know, tore them away from the protests. They arrested some of them. They arrested faculty and so on, and, you know, expelled people from campus as well. Just a whole bad look. But I mean, we see this happen time and time again. And I don't know, it seems like more fuel for the fire for the abolition of policing movement. You just look at these things and you see the absolutely like outweighed response from police and the way that they're willing to use violence for extremely stupid ends, because at the end of the day, like, none of these encampments are hurting anybody. Like, you know, it's not like these encampments are contributing to something bad even. They're just people, they're sitting out on the steps and they're demanding something. There's something violent amidst them. It's just police like overreacting, responding in really awful and like thuggish ways. Hate it.
It's not good. It's pretty bad. And I think it's also pulling into view, like, who is willing to be on the right side of the issue. That's one incredibly nice thing about the police, is they do kind of let you know who your friends are in a pretty obvious way. You know, for example, I'll call him out on this podcast because I think he's being extremely annoying on the internet. This guy, Tony Annette, in particular, I found very revealing in this moment. He's a guy, a liberal Catholic guy, who wrote a book called Cathonomics. I don't know what to say about it. A guy who stylizes himself as being very into social democracy and, like, I don't know, various forms of democratic socialism, but did work at the IMF and has a lot of increasingly right-wing opinions about all kinds of things, race and otherwise. Not a great, great trajectory for this one, but he, has also been talking a lot about, you know, just deriding the defund the police rhetoric in general, and explicitly defending the police under the pretext explicitly that in Colombia, some students, I guess, broke some windows and, like, I don't know, put some furniture on top of some other furniture, like pretty
bad
boilerplate stuff. Yeah, not pretty wild. But the police obviously responded to that in an incredibly militarized way, and he thinks that that's great and fine and good, and in fact that they should do that. And Colombia is doing the right thing by calling the cops on these students. And I think it's important to keep track of who is kind of showing their ass in public, you know. Like, for example, I mean, Tony Annette in particular is a guy who's published in a lot of progressive Catholic publications, making the case for social democracy. And if your social democracy means that also cops should just beat up students for saying that bombing tens of thousands of people in Palestine is not a good thing, then I'm sorry, that is very bad, actually. And you shouldn't be welcome in those kinds of spaces, you know? So I think I'm just singling him out, but he's not the only person. I think there's a lot of folks who are either saying or not saying, you know, what they mean in these kinds of moments. And it's significant to use that as kind of a crystallizing moment.
Yeah, totally. Well, I can't imagine the aftermath of this whole thing being anything but more people wanting to abolish the police. I guess that's like the dialectic take or whatever, but it's just the cycle continues of that dynamic. And I think that people will continue to be mad about it and kind of come around to see that abolition makes a lot of sense.
You know, we've talked about in this podcast in the past that one thing that has really activated and created a Christian left that knows how to think politically and knows how to think about imperialism and material conditions, historically, something that's generated that in the U.S. is anti-imperialist movements. And I'm thinking about the kinds of stuff that you saw come out of the protests against the Vietnam War first, in the 60s, that then pretty naturally evolved into the absorption of refugees from Chile and the affirmation of socialism and the kind of criticism of fascism in Chile that emerged in light of that movement, which gave rise to movements like Christians for Socialism, you know, an explicit kind of Christian commitment to this political ideology. And it's just making me think a lot right now in this particular moment that there are some analogies to that moment and also some huge differences. Like, we're kind of, you know, people who have been engaged for a while have leapfrogged a bit from, as you said, Matt, the kind of Occupy activization to then being activated more around movements for racial justice and accountability and reparations and so on, and now being pushed into this anti-imperialist kind of action, which is something that, you know, authors and revolutionaries and activists, like, people have drawn those dots in each of those movements for sure as they're happening, definitely. But I think for movement logic to kind of be able to grow out of these kinds of experiences, connecting the dots on purpose and so on, I'm very curious about what will happen. And especially when it comes to Christians, like, I think a lot of Christians were activated by Black Lives Matter. I mean, you saw lots of churches get involved, pastors, lots of books, theological writing that was done and is still being done on that particular issue because of the spark of that movement. I'm curious to see what's going to happen as a result of this movement. You know, could it provoke a deeper analysis of imperialism, a deeper analysis of U.S. empire, of Zionism, something that kind of, you know, cuts more directly than what Christians tend to kind of settle for in terms of criticizing the state and U.S. empire and so on. So that's my like cautious hope, or when, you know, when you allow yourself to be hopeful when there's a movement building, I'm hoping that this does something similar to what has been done in the past, where the crystallization on the suffering of a people at the hands of U.S. empire and its friends also starts to activate Christians thinking a lot more critically about, you know, what's going on politically, economically, and otherwise.
I've said a few times in this episode that we are old people, and I don't know, just an idea I'm really having to kind of come to terms with right now. I'm not on the front lines of these like university spaces or whatever, but I was thinking about the ways that the people experiencing this, how it will shape their politics. You know, in a lot of ways, you can't think about the idea of like an encampment or like occupying public space or even university space without thinking about the ways that Occupy Wall Street mm-hmm. contributed to those like forms of protest. And I think that's, you know, it's right to trace that sort of germ of protest back to Occupy. Of course, like it happened other places before Occupy, but you know, Occupy Wall Street is like such a defining moment for the left, for better or worse, in the United States of this particular era, right? That's not wrong to say, I guess. But the thing that I guess I've been thinking a lot about, like how these two things compare and contrast. And while Occupy Wall Street showed people that you can do, you can be annoying to people in power by like occupying space and like making yourself very loud and heard and everything like that, these protests are such, they're so different, I think, in a lot of ways. Like Occupy, like, was always trying to find like its footing about like what it actually was or what people were demanding. You know, generally it was some kind of like economic thing, but nobody could ever quite put their hand or their finger on like what it was. But these movements are really interesting because it's occupation, it's encampment, it's like but it's calling for something in particular that I think that was missing from previous types of Occupy protests. So it'll be interesting to see like how the political sensibilities of the people who are at the front lines of these encampments evolve over time and like what they think. I'm actually really fascinated because I think it's really easy for people who are, I think maybe like us, to look at the tactic of encampment and be like, well, like, what are you doing? Like Occupy Wall Street did this kind of thing, but did nothing. And like other types of movements did this kind of thing and did nothing. But I feel like there's a different type of approach to these encampments. And I'm interested to see what like people who are there and like organizing them will figure out and like what kind of direction they might be able to give going forward. It's a cool thing to think
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's also harder to placate this demand with surface level changes yeah. or changes in rhetoric. Like, you know, with Occupy, you got like some sort of vague pieces of legislation that I think were trying to respond to some of those demands, like Dodd-Frank maybe in part, and other kinds of stuff
yeah.
That emerged out of the housing crisis. But that was like pretty small potatoes. And because there was no, as you said, kind of discernible Occupy crystallized demand by design, it was easy to let it dissipate. And I think there was something similar with Black Lives Matter as well. You know, there was a demand for racial justice, for police accountability, you know, certain expressions of that movement or geographical centers maybe had stronger articulated demands than others. But at the end, what really changed was the discourse. You know, policy didn't really move in a hugely significant way. At the very least, like, it's not, you know, those movements came and the brands kind of picked them up and people sort of, I think on the whole, have at least found themselves okay with, you know, going on the way that things are, just in terms of like the capacities that movements have to like get people out and like, you know, continue to be mad about something. And when it comes to an issue like this, it's like, you know, Nike is not going to tweet like, we think genocide is bad in light of these student encampments, right? Like, you're not going to see like the next episode of Law and Order or something try to tackle the tough issue of Zionism the way that they might tackle like the tough issue of like, you know, police brutality or whatever. So like, I think that also is a huge kind of strength of a movement and makes it so much more challenging because like the stakes are higher. There's not a lot of compromise that can be made on them, or at least even the lessons of compromise will be revealing because they will not, you know, you won't be able to, like when students go to a university board and they're like, we want you to divest from Israel, and that board inevitably says no, and they vote no, and, you know, for no good reason, that will be such a defining moment for those particular students, an important moment of disappointment or victory. I mean, let's cross our fingers, I guess. But all that to say, like, I think having that crystallized set of demands and issues that can't be reabsorbed is pretty big.
Yeah, that's a great point. That nobody can put, no brands can start participating in such a huge deal. I love that. Great observation.
All right, we're at the end of the hour here, Matt. I don't know, how do we cap this thing off? I guess for my part, I guess I would just say I think it's an exciting opportunity for Christians to get involved, and it's also like a test of Christianity's relevance in a moment like this, in particular in higher ed. That's the thing that my brain keeps going back to. Like, what good is it to have Christians on campus if their own institutions can't, like, side with people being beat by police? But as they follow a religion literally premised on a guy being beat by police.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really powerful idea that there are seminaries in the United States that just, like, don't really care that that's happening to their students, or they've not spoken out about that. And yeah, if Christianity is a thing that doesn't make a difference in your life to the extent that you would say police beating students is bad, then what is the point? I don't know. Who cares, man? You've been saved, but from what? I'm not sure.
Yeah, from what and for what? And maybe the other thing that, I mean, we're running over time here, but the other thing that comes to mind for me is the kind of education that's happening in Palestine and theological education and so on in this moment, like something I think is really fascinating. We should have talked about this earlier maybe, but maybe I'll just leave this as a parting note. Something I think is really fascinating about Palestinian Christians is that they seem to have a pretty big drive and like ability to establish institutions in a situation where that seems really hard to do. For example, Christians run lots of hospitals, lots of schools, many of which have been destroyed or, you know, are kind of struggling along in a place like the West Bank or, you know, or Jerusalem or whatever. And I'm just thinking, for example, of like Mitri Raheb, the Palestinian Lutheran pastor, who is also the president of a university in the West Bank. You know, these are people who are like writing liberation theology, like doing good work. Like if you read his books, they're pretty impressive, pretty helpful, pretty important. They're also people who are like involved in higher ed, in education, in doing not just theological formation, but like equipping Palestinians with the skills that they need to try to build a society that works for them under a pretty brutal occupation. And maybe that's one thing that remains to be kind of sorted out, or dots that still remain to be connected, is like the connection between Palestinian Christians who are working in higher ed on purpose, which I think is actually a uniquely significant role that they're playing in Palestine, and the kinds of activism that's happening on campuses, you know, elsewhere. I think there's something really important there. And all that to say, I guess, it's an important moment to just start, you know, making sure that you're still reading Palestinian Christian writers like Mitri Raheb and so many other folks who are involved in institution building and movement building and resisting occupation. You know, they're still out there, still talking and still being annoying to lots of other people, including other Christians. And we kind of have to find a way to be adequate to that.
Thanks for listening to The Magnificast. If you like what you heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/TheMagnificast. If you join, you can get access to our very cool Patreon-only Discord chat where we talk about all kinds of good things. Man, Dean, you've been gone for the last few days, so you probably haven't seen it, but a bunch of us have been playing this very stupid AI game called President Simulator.
Oh, I did miss this. I have got to look it up right after this.
Yeah, so it's just like an AI chatbot that someone has kind of like trained in some way to pretend like you're the president, and you can do all kinds of very funny stuff. My very first run I did of it, I just I basically made sort of like a system of communes that was pretty fun. And it was mostly just me thinking about how you'd build a mass movement. But I was playing this other one earlier today, where the whole premise was that I was president of the United States, and I was also a wizard, and I've created an army of skeleton warriors. And that's been the bludgeon I've been wheeling around North America and threatening Canada with. So all I'm trying to say here is that AI is good for only one thing, and that is this one game where you get to pretend to be president. Pretty good.
And that is the kind of thing that you too can discover if you support us at patreon.com/themagnificguest.
Maybe you would pay us money to keep this kind of content away from you. And also, we could probably arrange that too. Our intro music is by Amaria Armstrong, and our outro music is by The Logical Spoon. And we'll see you next time.
Church in the morning, souls alive. Heaven come to earth and there won't be no church. We'll meet down by the riverside. There we'll swim with all creation. Never get tired, never bored. Don't worry, someday there'll be no dam between us and our Lord.